The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Masada and Mass Suicide, is the 13th of a 16-part series from Yavne to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the merit and honor of Leo and Marilyn Sroka.
Off the western shore of the Dead Sea stands one of Israel's most imposing and awesome formations, the Rock of Masada. Masada, its very name, conjures up images of unsurpassed courage and tragedy. Its defenders were the last of the Jews that dared to defy the might of the Roman legions. They held out for some 3 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, after the destruction of the temple. But even in defeat, they denied the Romans the joy of victory. Right before the final Roman onslaught, the defenders made a suicide pact in order to ensure their dignity, to prevent the enemy from enslaving and violating them. When the Roman conquerors finally scaled the summit of the Jewish stronghold, they were stunned at the sight that they beheld: the dead bodies of its 960 defenders. For modern Israelis, Masada has become a symbol of Jewish heroism. To this day, recruits of the armored units of the Israeli Defense Forces swear their oath of allegiance on Masada's heights with the words, "Shenit Masada lo tipol," "Masada shall not fall again." No. Just close it. But what is the real story of Masada? Were the defenders truly heroes? Were they merely members of an irresponsible fringe group that brought about their own destruction, the destruction of countless others, by recklessly resisting Roman rule? And how are we to look upon their pact of suicide? How does Jewish law treat suicide in general, and the suicide on Masada in particular? This and much more will be discussed tonight. But to fully understand what happened, we must first study the events that led up to the Roman revolt, and the psychology and history of the group that made its last stand on the fortress that stood on the now desolate rock of Masada. Our story begins in the year 6 of the Common Era. For some 70 years, the province of Judea had been under Roman rule. But it hadn't been a province that was part of the Roman Empire per se, but rather a client state with its own ruler that owed its allegiance and pay tribute, of course, to Rome. But in the year 6 of the Common Era, the province of Judea was annexed outright and became part of the Roman Empire. And it became part of the province of Syria, so that the president or governor of Syria really controlled the affairs of Judea. He had an underling that was called the procurator, who was responsible for affairs of Judea proper. And if you have the handout, the story of Masada is told by Josephus, and we quote here I'm quoting here from the various works of Josephus, his work on the war, and his work on antiquity, for the facts and the background of Masada. In the year 6, the Roman governor of Syria was a former Roman senator by the name of Cyrenius. And the procurator, in other words, the ruler over Judea, was Coponius. And they decided when they took power to make a census, in other words, to make an assessment of the properties of the Jews in order to tax them. And there was initially a resistance to this whole process. By and large, as Josephus explains, the people were pacified by the high priest. This is Joezer ben Bisus. However, there was a group that said basically, enough is enough. And they want their freedom. And there were two that Josephus names, Yehuda from the city of Gamala, this is in the north of Israel, and with him Tzaddok. As he says, this Tzaddok, he explains, is a Pharisee. It's his proper name was Tzaddok, a common name, but he was a Pharisee, who decided to revolt. Of course, the revolt was on a small scale, but it began the process that eventually led to the major revolt. And you could look at the facts as they're stated here on the pages. On the second page, when Josephus describes the various sects of the Jewish people, he divides them now into four sects. Because there were always three major sects, the Pharisees, this is the rabbinic leadership, the Sadducees, these were the secular Jews that practiced Judaism, but in their belief system they denied the idea of an afterlife, and the idea that God concerns himself with the affairs of man. The third sect was the Essenes. This is the discussion, the topic, last lecture. And now he describes a fourth sect, and these are the people, these zealots, these people bent on acquiring their liberty. And he describes them fully as a fourth group. Their beliefs were the beliefs of the Pharisees. Unlike the Sadducees and the Essenes, they did not have a separate belief system. However, they incorporated a new notion to the standard belief, the traditional belief. And that is, and we could read together, these men agree in all other things with the Pharisaic notions, but they have an inviolable attachment to liberty, and say that God is to be their only ruler and Lord. They also do not value dying any kind of death. In other words, which makes them really a very fierce adversary, as we find today with the Hamas. Nor indeed do they heed the deaths of their relations and friends. Nor can any such fear make them call any man Lord. So here he describes this growing group that eventually was formed the leadership of those who created the rebellion that led to the destruction of the Yerushalayim, of the Beis Hamikdash, of the temple. I have the last page of your notes. I have a list of the various procurators. In other words, those who were under the governor of Syria who controlled Judea. Since we are going to refer to various procurators as we go, and as Josephus develops this history, it just would be easy to look back, to have a sense of the chronology of when these things occurred. Josephus describes the reign of Tiberius Julius Alexander. This is from the year 46 to 48 of the Common Era. And as he describes, he was the son of the leader, the oligarch, the leader of the Jewish community in Alexandria. His uncle was the famous Jewish philosopher Philo. But he had totally turned his back on Judaism and was a pagan. He was appointed, this is Tiberius Alexander, was appointed as the procurator of Judea. And it's just interesting to note, and he describes just two facts of what occurred during his leadership. One is, there was a great famine. The help for the famine was brought by was alleviated through the philanthropy of a convert. This is Queen Helena. This is the Hilmi Amalka mentioned in the Talmud. Brought corn, brought grain in Egypt at great expense and distributed to those that were in want. It seems that the Roman procurators, the leadership, didn't bother alleviating the physical suffering of the Jews. Nor was the descendant of Herod, Agrippus II, who was the king of the Galilee, northern Israel, and some parts of East Jordan, neither did he help the Jews. Rather, it's a convert who is the queen of a foreign country. Her husband had already died. She moved to Israel. She was the queen of Chadayev. We're going to, in a further lecture, we're going to describe her story. She was the one who helped them. There was no, the government, just give a sense, the government was not interesting in helping the populace. The second event that he relates is we started this Yehuda, who was one of the leaders of this whole movement of revolt and independence, had children. And evidently it seems that the revolt was still smoldering. He was able to capture two of these of his sons. There's James, which is the Greek version of Yaakov, and Simon of Shimon, and he had them crucified. So from the little of the account that we have a sense of the period. It's a period where the government really is not concerned in helping the populace, just taxing them. And it's a period where there was revolt, and they mercilessly tried to squash it. In the year after Tiberius Alexander was procurator, the next procurator for a period of 4 years was a man called Cumanus. And under his leadership, there was a whole civil war. There was whole fighting between the Jews and the Samaritans. And the Romans seemed to have sided with the Samaritans. In fact, eventually this Cumanus was recalled because he had sided with them. And it describes now, in paragraph D, that the Galileans, who were at odds with the Samaritans, entreated the assistance of Elozer ben Dinius, a robber who had many years made his abode in the mountains, with which assistance they plundered many villages of the Samaritans. Eliezer ben Dinius, was a person whose exploits were recorded in the Talmud as well. And in the Medrash Shir HaShirim, we have a little inkling of what the opinion of the Pharisees, of the Perushim, the Rabbonim, of the events that occurred. And here we have on paragraph D on page 2, As a medrash, Rav Unia said, God administered four oaths corresponding to the fourth generations that pressed for a premature termination of the Golos. And they stumbled. In Shir HaShirim, there's an allusion that that this woman makes an oath to the daughters of Jerusalem four times. This is an allusion, according to the Medrash, of four oaths that the Jews in Golos should not rebel against their foreign masters. One of the people mentioned, one of the generations, is Dinius, is Eliezer ben Dinai. And it seems that this was all, it wasn't just a question of defense. It was a question that they wanted to throw out Roman rule. The opinion of the Pharisees was different than this group. That Golos, that this thing was something that God had to remove. It was brought on by the shortcomings of the Jews. It was a punishment. It would only be terminated if the Jews would do tshuva, if they would repent. And all those attempts that the Jews made to assert themselves only ended up in tremendous tragedy. And this period, we see from the Medrash, and this person in particular, are mentioned in conjunction with this whole attitude. The attitude of how appealing it is, of never again, was really something frowned upon by the Medrash. And basically that was the attitude of those who eventually brought upon the whole destruction of the temple. So the first phenomenon that we've discussed is this freedom movement. Now we're going to discuss another phenomenon of the period, and that's of the Sicarii. On page 3, Josephus takes us to the period when Festus, this is between the year 60 and 62 of the Common Era, you could refer to the last page, was procurator. Upon Festus coming into Judea, it happened that Judea was afflicted by the robbers, while all the villages were set on fire and plundered by them. So besides the idealists, we had another group of criminals. And then then besides now the robbers, we have this third phenomenon. Here we have a whole breakdown of law and order, this whole fermenting of revolt, and we have the group called the Sicarii. He identifies Josephus as robbers. In other places he identifies them with the zealots. The word Sicarii comes from the small swords that they held, and they were basically, they assassinated people. It's hard to get an objective account through Josephus, of course, as Josephus took the side of the Romans. But it's interesting just from what he tells us. For they mingled, this is in the middle of paragraph A, they mingled themselves among the multitude at their festivals. And when they were come up in crowds from all parts of the city to worship God, and easily slew those that they had mind to slay. So there was a whole terror now in the populace. As he describes in other places, when they went up to be Oyla Regal, and as they went up to Yerushalayim, they're afraid for their lives. They don't know that the person standing next to them doesn't have a weapon and kill them. He doesn't describe, though, who those enemies were and who these people that they wanted to kill were. But what's interesting to note is something which seems to be very, very topical, seems to be something which is in the news today. As in paragraph B, and see. He describes the reign of Albinus. This is, again, if you look, this is between 62 and 64. He was the reform candidate, so to speak. He came in and wanted to clean up the mess. So he came to Yerushalayim. He used all his endeavors and care to come and be kept in peace, this by destroying many of the Sicarii. So far, so good. How did the Sicarii fight back? But now the Sicarii, paragraph C, went into the city by night just before the festival, which is now at hand, and took the scribe belonging to the governor of the temple, whose name was Eliezer, who was the son of Ananus. This is the high priest. So they took a son of the high priest and bound him and carried him away with them. After which they sent to Ananus and said that they would send the scribe to him if he would persuade Albinus to release 10 of those prisoners which had been caught of their party. So Ananus was plainly forced to persuade Albinus and gained his request of him. This is a classic case of being forced by terrorists and a hostage to release their prisoners. What was the upshot? This was the beginning of greater calamities. For the robbers perpetually contrived to catch some of Ananias' servants. And when they had taken them alive, they would not let them go until they thereby recovered some of their own Sicarii. And as they were again became no small number, they grew bold and were in great affliction to the whole country. And only this would be some guidance of ancient history for events today. So now we've discussed three phenomena. Again, the independence movement, the breakdown of law and orders, of these whole groups of robbers, and the idea of terror, of the Sicarii. We have now a fourth phenomenon in this period, and this is the people who claim themselves to be Mashiach. And he goes in different detail here. He describes here on section 3, paragraph A, the time of Fados. This goes back to the year 44 to 46. There was a man named Tudus. And he took a whole group, and this is they follow him to the Jordan, and he told us he would divide the river. You know, just follow me. Well, Fados then evidently was not a big believer. He took a group of his horsemen, went after them, fell upon them unexpectedly, slew many of them, took many of them alive. But he took Tudus, the self-acclaimed Mashiach, alive and cut off his head and carried to Yerushalayim. And it goes on to say that he was not the last of these. And as he describes the breakdown, again, I hope you're getting a sense of what's happening here, what was festering during the period that led to the revolt. On page 4, describes in the period of Felix, and you can turn back, this is from the year 52 to 60, his reign was quite long. The country was again filled with robbers and imposters. Notice the imposters refer to these false messiahs who deluded the multitude. And again, the policy of the Romans was to stamp out anything that disturbed the peace. Yet Felix Ketchum put in many of those imposters every day together with the robbers. Evidently, there must have been many Mashiachs. He also caught Eliezer the son of Dineus, which we had mentioned before, who had gotten together a company of robbers. And now here we have a sense that things are getting better. Right? Because of the sense, here's a man who stands for law and order. But in the Pasuk, he gives us also a sense of how the Sicarii came to be. Which is, remember before he described them, how did it come about? Felix here, this is on page 4, continue. Felix had a problem with the high priest. The high priest evidently had a hand in bringing Felix. Evidently he knew the man. And evidently he felt, you owe me something. And he kept on giving his advice and making his life a little uncomfortable. So Felix decided the only way to deal with the man was to do away with him. He couldn't do it with him overtly, but he decided to do it covertly. So he hired a group, this is robbers he described, and they came up to Yerushalayim, and they had these daggers. He was the first one to hire hitmen. And as this murder says, like this, and they slew John, they slew the Kohen Gadol, and he claimed, well, I don't know anything about this. But then, it says, it was never avenged, and they felt that they have now a free reign. So they started doing this. Well, I mean, he was just one of the list. They just evidently had a whole hit list. You know? He was just the top of the hit parade, you know. But so robbers went, and they kept on, and evidently this began the whole movement of this terror. So here we find, on one hand, we would look to this person as, here's a person for law and order. On the other hand, he evidently was just as corrupt as the others. And then one wonders, were these robbers that he claimed, were they really robbers that he killed? Or really people who had true complaints that were part of this resistance movement? And he just called them robbers as a cover-up for all that he was doing. Another event, as he describes in terms of these false messiahs, again, it's quite interesting. There was a man who came out of Egypt. This again was at the time of Felix. And again, he said he is going to conquer Jerusalem, and the walls are going to fall down by themselves. Felix heard about this. Again, he brought with him a great number of horsemen, of footmen, on page 5, attacked the Egyptians and the people that were with him, the Egyptian and the people with him. He also slew 400 of them and took 200 alive. The Egyptian himself escaped out of the fight, did not appear anymore. You know, it just ruins a career, you know. This messianic fever is not just described in the books of Josephus. In the works of the sect of the Dead Sea, you know, that we discussed last time, there's a whole literature they have. And one of the works that was discovered was in the War Scroll, which describes what is going to be the war, the final war at the time of the Messiah. And they look at the enemy the Kittim, which is normatively understood as the Romans. In rabbinic literature, the Kittim are the Romans. And just to give you a sense of how they looked at this, this is what we have on paragraph D. The dominion of the Kittim shall come to an end, and iniquity shall be vanquished, leaving no remnant. For the sons of darkness, there shall be no escape. As they say, them's his fighting words. You know, because after these words, I just took another. The priest shall sound it, marshal them into the divisions of the formation. It goes into detail of how they're going to fight this war. At the sound of the trumpets, the column shall deploy until every man is in his place. And the priest shall sound a second signal on the trumpets for him to advance. And when the foot soldiers approach, throwing distances of the formation of the Kittim, was getting close. Every man shall seize his weapon of war. The priest shall blow the weapons of massacre. And the Levites and all the blowers of ram's horn shall sound a battle alarm. And the foot soldiers shall stretch out their hands against the host of the Kittim. The sound of the alarm, they shall begin to bring down the slain. All the people shall cease their clamor, and the priests shall continue to blow the trumpets of massacre, and the battle shall be fought against the Kittim. The Kittim. It's interesting to note that from the ruins of Masada were found what clearly is remnants of people of the Dead Sea sect as well, because their literature was also found amongst the personal effects of those on Masada. So it was not just, we'll say, the majority of Jews. And as he explained, those, the resistance fighters, were actually Pharisees. In other words, but they were joined by this group, this which seems to have this messianic, this fringe element as well. So again, just let me just put things into its proper perspective. Here we have a whole breakdown of society. We have a whole resistance movement that begins. We have a whole breakdown of law and order where people plunder whole villages. We have terror of the Sicarii who go and assassinate people. And we have this messianic movement. We'll stop for a second, and we're going now to understand the backdrop of Masada itself. That is the hilltop of Masada. This is the top is north. And in the middle here, that area on the west is where the Romans broke down the fortifications. Can't see it, but there's a ramp right below on this, on the left side. You're on page 5, section 4. Josephus, in great detail, in this last book of the Roman Wars, describes this fortress of Masada. It was originally built, according to Josephus, by Jonathan, you know, the high priest. Normally, in the nomenclature of Josephus, Jonathan the high priest was one of the Maccabee brothers, one of the five brothers. There was another Jonathan, Yonason, who was from that family. He was a great nephew of this Jonathan the high priest. He was King Yanai, it was Yanai HaMelech. There were five brothers. The last surviving brother was Shimon. Shimon's son was Yochanan, and Yochanan's son was Yanai. This Yanai, it seems from coins that we have, Hebrew name, even though Josephus never mentions it, is Yonason. But it would seem, just from the casual reading, that the Jonathan referred to here was the first. However, the excavators on Masada found no evidence of such an early creation. But they did find many coins of Yanai, which led the excavators to believe that possibly there's an error here, that the Jonathan was really, as he had heard, that Jonathan was really the King Yanai, which makes historically a lot more sense as well. And there's one, but Herod was the one who created what we have here today. Yanai reigned from the year 103 before the Common Era to the year 76 before the Common Era. So again, we don't have a firm date, but it's that time. Herod became king in the year 37 before the Common Era, died in the year 4 before the Common Era. And he built a fortress and a palace. The top of that the picture, as you just barely see, is the northern palace, and it's really a palace. The reason you can't see is because it has three tiers, and this is just the top, and it keeps on going down through levels. He, in great detail, does Josephus describe the wall and the edifices. The height of the wall was 12 cubits. Its breadth was 8 cubits. Actually, the wall, which we'll describe again, was a... If you could just show you. Was a dual level... It's a dual wall. It was a casement wall. There's a wall and an empty space and another wall. So really, it's a dual wall. And this was common in that time for protection. If you go through the first, there's still the second you have to go through. And he describes 38 towers, each of them 50 cubits high, that people could mount, you know, could shoot arrows, that they had... They had machines that shot arrows and shot stones. And he describes the palace that he built in page 6. The wall was very high and strong, and four corner towers 60 cubits high. And he describes the furniture and the pillars and how beautiful it was. This is taken from the remnants of this northern palace. The columns, as you see, which were placed in the wall, they're actually made out of alabaster and plastered, and you had an effect as if they looked marble. They truly were not marble. Are still retain their beauty. And if you notice the bases of the columns and how they were painted to give an effect as if they look like marble. You see a close-up of those pillars, and the excavators were able to take out, and this is all the dust of generations, and to restore to what we just have a sense of what it must have looked like. He also, besides the beauty of this and the security of this, he wanted to make sure that he had sufficient provisions for a long siege. And he have in the second paragraph on page 6, he described, he laid up corn in large quantity, substance meant for a long time, wine, oil abundance, all kinds of pulse, which were beans, and dates heaped together. This is reconstructed one of the storage rooms from the sauna. These are some of the produce that were found. If you go from left to right, these are the seeds of olives. What's the remnant of olives? These are walnuts. This is, on the right, is dates. And again, below, this pomegranates. On the lower left hand, the middle lower, is grain. Looks like wheat. And on the right lower is salt. This was all found amongst the rubble. It has still been preserved. These are jugs that stored liquids. They're still preserved. Okay, we're gonna stop. One of the reasons he created this massive fortress was not only to protect them from revolt of the Jews, because he was very much hated by the Jews. He gave them, he was very repressive, taxed them terribly, and used the money of taxation for the non-Jews of his country to build their temples and edifices. But more so, he was afraid that since he was only a client state of Rome, and in one period, Mark Antony, who was very much attached to Cleopatra, was in control of that whole area. Cleopatra laid her eyes on Judea. She wanted Antony to give it to her. And therefore, he was ready to mount a resistance, and that's why he created, was one of the reasons why he was so careful in creating this massive fortress and basically this palace in exile. So again, we have two players here. We have the Jews who are ready for revolt, as we described, and we have this fortress of Masada. Last time we touched upon the beginnings of the revolt. The last of the procurators was Gessius Florus. And when Gessius Florus mounted an attack against Jerusalem and the temple, demanding 17 talents of silver out of the temple treasury, the Jews decided they weren't going to just sit there. And they defended themselves, and Florus was forced to retreat, but left a Roman garrison in Antonia, which was a fortress just north of the temple, and in the palace that was formerly Herod's palace. After Florus left, the Jews revolted, killed and burned Antonia, this fortress north of the temple, and then went on to attack the Roman garrison that was in Herod's palace, Herod's former palace in Jerusalem. The leader of that revolt was a son of the original founder of this freedom movement. He said the founder of freedom was Yehuda of Galilee. This was a son of his. As soon as they started the revolt, they felt they had to be armed. So they went and attacked the Roman garrison that was stationed in Masada. It was after Herod left, and after it was really annexed and became part of the Roman Empire. The Romans just didn't leave Masada just standing there barren, but had a Roman garrison there. Somehow, I mean, the Romans were not waiting, you know, were not prepared for this. They came in and captured the Roman garrison there on Masada. It's not clear how they did this, he doesn't describe. But they captured them probably through cunning. In other words, they weren't, you know, they got them unaware. They killed the Romans there. And what more important is, they got control of Masada, and they got control of the armory in Masada. This was Herod's armory and the armory of the Romans. So they had all these arms and they went and took them and used them for the revolt against the Romans. The leader of this, again, this Menachem, this is on page 7, paragraph C, the son of Yehuda, who was the founder of this resistance movement, when he successfully, after he broke in, got the arms, he successfully attacked the Roman garrison in Jerusalem, in Herod's former palace, and eventually they killed the Roman soldiers. He decided that he wanted to be the new ruler of Jerusalem. Evidently, he just did not win on the popular ballot. There was a strong feeling from the populace not to accept him. And in fact, he was slain, this Menachem, and his followers were forced to flee to Masada. So the group who eventually got to Masada were the followers of this Menachem, who after they were too, it seems they were just too radical, even for the radicals of Jerusalem, and they were forced to flee back to Masada, the remnant. And one of them was Eliezer, the son of, how he says, Zayarius ben Yoir, who was akin to Menachem, and he was the one who led the resistance on Masada. The temple was destroyed in the year 70. The Jews now, who occupied Masada, as we explained, these were Pharisees by and large. These were Jews who kept Shabbos and Kashrus and all the mitzvahs. As Josephus described, they just had one extra thing. And this is the idea of the resistance. And they built a shul. They built a synagogue on Masada. This is the oldest, basically the remnants that we have archaeologically of the oldest synagogue, is the synagogue in Masada. And it faced, the Oren Kodesh faced towards Yerushalayim. It was near the synagogue and the walls there that they found remnants of Kisvei HaKodesh. They found holy, you know, the holy writings of the Torah, you know, in the area close to the synagogue. They also had their own economy. These are copper coins, and these are silver coins, were minted by the resistance fighters in Yerushalayim. These coins are written in the ancient Hebrew script, which they wrote specifically for the coins. And they are numbered according to years of the resistance. Even though this is really, it's a reverse. I mean, how it came out on the, you know, the slides. You can show you. This is the thing that looks like a W there is a shin. So here we find the remnants of an economy. This is the remnant. We found there was a. We're going to get back to the end of towards the end of the lecture. This was a woman's sandal. The skeleton, the skull of the woman and her husband, their child were found, but this sandal was still. So it was still intact. Here are utensils. I don't know if it looks like anything in your kitchen, but you know, maybe they do look pretty useful. These are lamps. This is how lamps were made. That little, the empty, the ending on the far side is where the wick came out of. Inside was the oil. This is a this is on the left side is a comb. This they used to have a which is mentioned in the Talmud that they used to have they used to put something in their eyes. See, in the lower right hand side, find this is the applier, you know, they put mascara. Was the thing really? They put it in near their eye. This is a palette. I think. This is a made out of shell. This is a palette which contained the cosmetics. Okay, just leave it. You can keep it on. So actually, most of these things, by the way, were found in the area between, we said, the walls around Masada were made of two walls. And eventually it was just meant between the gates and that the troops would be able to go in between the walls for defense. But when the people came in, and it seems the people came in from all around, escaping from the Romans, and there was no place to house these people lived in between the two walls. And that's where many of the items were found in between the walls. The first general in the Judea after the fall of Jerusalem was Bassus. After Bassus came Flavius Silva. And he decided really to crush what was the last remaining area of Roman resistance. He built, which was common with the Romans, he built a wall around the entire fortress. In other words, that whole area that no one should escape. Because they meant business. Because they weren't afraid they'll escape and then reform some other place and give them problems. So they wanted to totally destroy them. So they built a wall all around, and they built a camp, or camps, around the area to put their soldiers. The area where their encampment was still has not been disturbed on the desert floor to this day. And notice, you can see this is where the camps were. And it is still engraved and etched. There, it says, the stone is where the soldiers were housed during their campaign against Masada. Eventually, how he was able to gain victory was that on the western side, which was the most accessible, he built a tremendous ramp, which exists today, out of dirt and of timber. So it's interlaced, the dirt and the timber, and they had a whole ramp. And they just didn't walk up the ramp. They put on the ramp, they put basically their machinery, their battering ram, and they're able to knock down the walls. And of course, all the while, they were able also to, they had special machines, balustras, to shoot rocks against the, you know, against the potos, that they shouldn't, like, basically shouldn't disturb them, to keep them off the walls while they're working. These are some of the rocks. They're like grapefruits in those, that were shot hurling against the defenders. How big is it? A grapefruit. Here's, we covered some arrowheads. Not clear if they were from the defenders or they were from the enemies that were just shot through. They eventually were able to break down the wall, which was on the western side. But the defenders decided to thwart their efforts, and they built a wall behind that wall, not Herod's wall, but a wall made out of timber. It seems they took off the storage houses had timber roofs. They took off all the available timber that was in the fortress and built this wall. And they filled it with dirt and the timber. So the battering ram, which was good against a hard, you know, something hard like rock, didn't have effect on this soft material. So the Romans decided to burn the second wall. And as they started to burn the wall, a wind came, in the direction of which went towards the Romans. So it started now flaming out towards the Romans and started, they were afraid of burning all their battering rams. But the wind took a sudden change and moved towards the wall and started burning the wall. As the wall was burning and the Romans were sure there would be no basic resistance of the wall, they would be able to go, and through the burnt wall, the char, the remains, they decided to sleep the night and to prepare for the attack the following morning. And here on page 9, which we have one of the most unusual chapters of history, remember we said this is Eliezer ben Yoir, who is the leader, as Josephus describes, and there were survivors, that it was his idea that they should all commit suicide. And at great length, Josephus records, or purportedly records, the speech, which is a very lengthy, of this Eliezer, this is Eliezer ben Yoir, to try to convince the people to all commit suicide. Again, as much of Josephus' works, one has, is it, in other words, how did he know with such length to create this speech? You know, or if I would be there, this is what I would have said, you know. So it's very hard to know. But at the end, just if one looks on page 9, on the bottom page 9, this is part of his speech. He says, "We were the very first that revolted from them, and we were the last to fight against them." This is 3 years, you have to realize, after, this is 3 years after the defeat of Jerusalem, and they're still holding out. "And I cannot but esteem it as a favor that God hath granted us, that is still in our power to die bravely, and in a state of freedom, not the case of others who were conquered unexpectedly. Let our wives die before they are abused, and our children before they have tasted of slavery. And after we have slain them, let us bestow that glorious benefit upon one another mutually and preserve ourselves in freedom as an excellent funeral monument for us. Let us destroy our money and the fortress by fire, for I am well assured that this will be of great grief to the Romans. They shall not be able to seize us upon our bodies and shall fail of our wealth also, because they can't take us as slaves. Let us spare nothing but our provisions, for they will be a testimonial when we are dead that we were not subdued for want of necessities, that according to our original resolutions we have preferred death before slavery." And it's interesting how he describes, after they had made this pact, and he describes the pact on page 10 towards the bottom. "Miserable men indeed were they, whose distress forced them to slay their own wives and children with their own hands, as the lightest of those evils that were before them. So they, being not able to bear the grief that they were under for what they had done any longer, and esteeming an injury to those they had slain to leave in the shortest space of time after them." First they killed their wives and children. "They presently laid all they had in a heap, as their possession set fire to it. Then they chose 10 men by lot out of them to slay all the rest, every one of whom laid himself down by his wife and children on the ground and threw his arms about them, and they offered their necks to the stroke of those who by lot executed that melancholy office. And when these 10 had without fear had slain them all, they made the same ruling for casting lots for themselves." Notice, so they killed the wives and children together. Then they were last. "And he whose lot it was should first kill the other 9, and after all should kill themselves." So first they had 10 who killed all of them. These last 10 had one who killed the rest. "And they continues, the 9 offered their neck to the executioner, and he was the last of all, took a view of all the other bodies, lest perchance some of others among so many that were slain should want his assistance to be quite despaired, as they shouldn't be suffering. When he perceived that they were all slain, he set fire to the palace, with the great force of his hands ran his sword entirely through himself, and fell down dead next to his own relations." It's interesting that they found on Masada a lot. This reads in the cursive handwriting, Ben Yoir. And they actually claim this was the lot of Eliezer Ben Yoir, the leader. This was one of the lots that's described here in Josephus that they discovered. In fact, the Gal Yadin, the excavator of Masada, and that really this was the most emotional part when he found this lot. You know, like, however, there were in that northern palace, they found the remnants. They didn't find any other. They found one place that had some bodies, but in the northern was untouched. They found the remains of a husband and a wife and a child. This is the plaited hair of that woman that was in such a good state of preservation. This is amazing. But there were those who survived to tell the story. Yet there was an ancient woman, another one who was akin to Eliezer, and superior to most women in prudence and learning, with five children, who had concealed themselves in caverns underground, had carried water thither for their drink, and were hidden. So he had this old woman and a mother of five kids. Those who died were 960 women and children. And it occurred the first day of Pesach, some 3 years after the destruction of the temple. I'd like right now, before we start the second section, I'd just like to give 5 minutes. You can for questions and answers. If you want, you can get up and just think, because we want to get up, and then we'll continue on, because we're going to now the second section of what is, how do we look at what, how does halacha, as Jews, look at what they did on the Masada. So we'll, in 5 minutes, we'll start again. Seems that the Romans disposed of the bodies, except for a few. That was one of them, what we saw. There's the skull. I mean, they did find something. But yet, the Romans came there and had to live there. There was a Roman garrison after the defeat. The Romans housed the garrison on Masada. So evidently what they said, that they had to do this, so they disposed of their bodies. How then, we don't know. Yeah. No, you know, the dating, the question when the dating is, the temple was destroyed in the year 70. This occurred, the capture of Masada occurred in the year 73. Yes. Yeah, the question that was asked was, what's the difference that the rebellion now was frowned upon in the Roman times, as except for this group of resistors, was considered a fourth group. But the mainstream, the Pharisees, the Rabbonim, were against this revolt. So why is it in Roman times the Rabbonim were against the revolt, in the time of the Maccabees it was looked upon with such favor? Right? That's the question. The Romans did not want to prevent the Jews from observing the Torah. The Beis HaMikdash was in existence. There were yeshivas. There was no attempt to destroy the practice of Judaism. It was merely, as it's been for 2,000 years, it's been golus. This is golus. This is a curse that one has to accept. You can't do anything. If you try to, this, it just gets worse. These were the oaths that were alluded to, that golus is something that will be only removed if we change spiritually. The Maccabee revolt was created because the Greeks, the Syrian Greeks, made it a crime to practice Judaism. And therefore this was an act of really of
of the preservation of the Torah itself. And that's why it's looked upon in such favor, the Maccabee revolt. But it was not a revolt for independence. They did not gain independence, in fact, originally from the, at the time of the revolt. And even years later, they were still paying taxes to the Syrians. It was only some 30 years after the events, 25, 30 years, that they became independent. But at the victory itself, they were still really part and parcel of the Syrian Empire. Right, yeah, because it wasn't, they did not allow, the Beis HaMikdash had been converted to a pagan temple. So under this, it's like a Shas HaShmat. It's a time when Judaism becomes illegal, that one is required basically to give up one's life to preserve Judaism. It's like a different... Yeah, as he said, the question is, how did Josephus know the details of what happened? And the answer is, at least this is Josephus's answer, that there were seven survivors. There were two women and five children. They were there in the initial stages, but before the final slaughter, they saved themselves. And they were the ones who told the story. Again, we're not saying that it could be that there's much embellishment by Josephus' part. That we will never know. I'd like to begin now with the second section, which is, how does Halacha look upon the suicide of Masada? First, it's important on page 11, note that suicide is forbidden by Jewish law. Here we bring, if you can look through the notes, there is at least how the Talmud understands this, that there's a prohibition of not only taking someone else's life, but taking one's own life as well. And the language is ach es dimchem lenafshesechem edrosh, which the Talmud understands and interprets, surely your blood, if you take your own lives, will I require, means bring to judgment after death. In other words, the soul, after death, we brought to judgment for this. What the nature of that judgment is not specified in the verse. However, it's a there's a common accepted notion that called Hama'abad Atzmoy Ladas Ein Lechelik Loilam Habo. Someone who commits suicide has no portion in the world to come. The Tiferes Yisroel, Yisroel Lipschitz, one of the commentators on the Mishnah, offers the explanation, perhaps the Rambam explains, that any murderer has no portion in the world to come. And there's no difference of killing someone else or killing oneself. The person who kills himself is not afforded the normal dignity that a regular, that someone who dies a normal death. This is what we take from the Shulchan Aruch. This is Hama'abad Atzmo Ladas Ein Misaskon Imo. One who willfully takes his own life. The language Ein Misaskon Imo is, we're not involved with him. The language is really not clear. The commentators quote a responsa from the Rajba that says it does not mean we don't bury him, even though we're going to find an alternate opinion. So we do afford him, but the dignity, the kriya, the mourners tear their clothing, they sit shiva, that dignity is not afforded to him. What about suicide for someone who is dying already? Okay, that's a normal suicide. A person is in good health and just decides, whatever reason, that wants to terminate life. That's clearly covered in what we've studied up until now. What happens if the person is dying anyway, wants to end it quicker? We know in terms of murder that if someone is in the last moments of life, but yet you take decide to just end it quickly, it's considered murder. That's why a person who is in his last gasps for life, one kid's not allowed to move. It's a gosace. Because somehow you'll bring it just a little bit closer. Just like you are not allowed to kill the person, bring his end closer. The person himself is not allowed either. There's a Gemara which is widely quoted, Rala says, as the really the source. This when Chanina, this is Ben Trajan, this is one of the ten martyrs, was killed. He was actually not killed by the sword, but he was burned at the stake. And they put on him, they had soaked wool in water to retard the burning, put it over his chest so make that the burning would take all that longer, so he would have all that suffering before it reached his vital organs. And his students, his disciples, were with him as he was dying and after the fire had been lit. And he says, open your mouth and let the fire enter you. In other words, because of smoke, hurry it up so you shouldn't suffer so much. And he replied, says, Mutav shitlenu mi shinesona, val yechbol ba'atzma, chavol ba'atzma. It's preferred the one who placed it in man, Hashem, should take it. The person himself should not remove it. And that statement is really one of the major sources dealing in the halachic responsa about the situation of suicide in the face when a person ultimately is dying. It's not a question of a person's health. A person is dying already. But yet he wants to hurry up the process, and this is used as a source that one is not allowed to hurry up the process. So in a case of the assisted suicide, the person is dying and the person is helping the person along, so really what is happening, at least from the sources we have here, is the person who is committing suicide is committing the crime of taking his own life. Can't take somebody else's life, can't take your own life. The person who's helping is aiding, abetting this murder. So it's really, it's lifni evil sita michshol, you're not allowed to put a stumbling block in front of the blind, which relates to you're not allowed to help one do something which is wrong. You can't be an accessory for a crime. It's interesting that last week we went over the story, 2 weeks ago, in a sort of Josephus. As Josephus committed, as the people around him committed suicide, he tried to dissuade them, and finally they picked lots. He happened to come out the last. Some people are just all the luck. In his speech, at least this is how Josephus records a speech of how he's trying to dissuade them. I have here, it's on page 12, at the bottom of the page. He says, self-murder is a crime most remote from the common nature of all animals, an instance of impiety against God or Creator. Nor indeed is there any animal that dies by its own contrivance or by its own means. For desire, I guess, except for lemmings, I guess, for desire of life is a law engraved in them all. So he says it's unnatural. This is his... Again, he's trying to persuade these people not to commit suicide. He goes on to say, you can look at it yourself, on page 13 here, says in the middle, says, while the souls of those whose hands have acted madly against themselves are received by the darkest place in Hades, in Gehenna. He looks at it as a terrible crime of committing suicide. And he continues on, accordingly, our laws determine that the bodies of such as kill themselves should be exposed till the sun be set without burial. In other words, eventually he says they have anything, they may be buried, but the thing of the hurrying up, the burying process, that kovod, that special honor, is not afforded to one's dead. This is not brought in halacha, but evidently is reflective, at least of his, probably not of his views, but which was common, which seemed to have been common in his time. So at least it doesn't seem they're not buried at all, but the idea of one has to hurry up the burial until the sun is set doesn't apply, although at the same it would be allowed by them to be allowed to bury our enemies, and as our enemies are buried before the sun sets. As of a non-Jew, this is the case in the book of Joshua, of Yeshua, that the kings that were killed by the five kings were buried before the sun set. Person commits suicide, at least according to Josephus, does not get that dignity of a speedy burial. If we will assume then, when I said that the source point that there's a terrible crime to commit suicide, is suicide ever allowed? Is it ever lawful to commit suicide? It's interesting that Josephus, when he describes, when he finally, after the lottery, he and a colleague were still alive. They gave themselves up to Vespasian, the Roman general. And he comes to Vespasian, he says, I know what was the laws of Jews in this case, this is Vespasian, how it becomes generals to die. In other words, the generals generally did commit suicide, at least from, again, this is not a halacha, but this is Josephus. The generals did commit suicide. And we do find a parallel, which is brought in halacha in two places. We find the incident by Saul, by Shaul HaMelech, that after he had been defeated in the battlefield, he had been severely wounded, he was in the process of dying. He told his armor bearer, says, draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest the uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. Yisalaluvi, they play with me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. Saul killed himself. And the Medrash, Bracious Rabbah, on the verse that we had quoted before where there's a prohibition to commit suicide, says, this is Yochel Kishol, I would think, this is how it's normally understood, this is most commentaries understand this, I would think that the prohibition extends to a person like Saul as well, King Saul, for committing suicide. Talmud Loimer, that's why the scripture teaches us by saying the word ach. It says ach es dimcha menav shesecha medrash. The word ach is understood, at least on the level of the drosha, as with reservation. In other words, that it doesn't apply to the case of Shaul, of Saul. What if we assume this is the majority view, that Saul was allowed to commit suicide? What was the difference between his suicide and the normative case where suicide is not allowed? And here we have a whole variance of opinion. The Shach in Simon Kufnun Zion, this is in 157 in Yoredeya, quotes the Sefer Mitzvos Ketanos. Says that those martyrs that killed themselves because they did not believe that they would be able to withstand the test of torture. There was in the period of the Crusades, there were whole cities that were put upon by these masses, and they were forced either to give up their lives or to be baptized. In a community after community, they committed suicide. Not only did they commit suicide, but they killed, I mean, just like in Masada, they killed their wives and children, because they were afraid that they would not be able to stand the test. So the smock maintains that they are kedoshim, they are martyrs. They were allowed, and the proof is from Saul, from Shaul HaMelech. As they learn to be Salalbi, that they will make fun of me, is similar to a verse which we have in the idea of Tzchok, we have by Yishmol, which the Medrash understands that to be idolatry. Basically is that there's a man dying and they'd force him to kiss the idol or to do something just to, you know, to relieve the torture. And how their understanding was that Saul killed himself not to avoid the pain, because according to this, it was like, just like Hanani ben Trajan, in other words, just like the Tana, one of the ten martyrs, that would not speed his death as he's being burned to alleviate pain, but rather because he wasn't sure that he would be able to stand the test of, you know, doing something which is wrong, like idolatry, if they would force him in this condition. And this is how it seems, this is how these Rishonim learn. The Bach quotes this. The Bedek HaBayis quotes this in the name of the Or HaChaim. There's also one of the Rishonim. However, there's another opinion which the Or HaChaim quotes that has a different, which is a minority opinion, that Saul, they have an alternate interpretation, the Medrash, Saul was not allowed to commit suicide. But the majority opinion is, the interpretation is, he was allowed, but they're interpreting it as because to avoid doing this, of compromising themselves. We find a parallel to this, not based on this drasha, not on the comparison to Saul, but we find there's a Gemara in Gittin, in 57b, there were 400 boys and girls who were carried off for prostitution, for immoral purposes, by the Romans. And you could look at the notes on page 15. They all committed suicide, and it was considered praiseworthy. And the idea was, as Tosfos explains, because they did this to prevent themselves from being involved in these moral endeavors. This is the basis. There's a famous story of a whole group of girls from Beis Yaakov in World War II that would be taken for prostitution that all committed suicide. This is the precedent. So it seems from the Gemara clearly that one is allowed to commit suicide to prevent one from doing an immoral act that normally one wouldn't be allowed to do and would be afraid that they would break down. And that would be the comparison to the baptism or to this immoral purpose as mentioned in the Gemara and Gittin. But there's another way, and there's several ways, there's another way of learning, of understanding the situation by Saul. Because up until now, the first explanation was because they would force him to do something that would be wrong. But he would just be in such pain, he would do it. And he would commit suicide before they would force him to do this. The other explanation, and this is brought down in Yorah Deh and Shin Mem Hei, about what deals with the laws of, as we brought before, about the dignity afforded to one who committed suicide. The language of the Shulchan Aruch, this is thinking about Godel is an adult, not a child, that commits suicide, who onus, and he was forced, kishol hamelach, ein moinim mena kol dover. We don't take, in other words, we don't remove any of the, not deprived of any of the honors that he would normally have. The Shach explains that what was, according to this, the basis over here does not seem to be because of religious connotation, but rather, as the Shach says, this is from the Rosh, because he killed himself because the Philistines would do unto him according to their desires and afterwards kill him. Over here in this mention, there's no mention of the religious element as was mentioned by the Smach, but rather, simply because of the torture itself. He'd be tortured and then killed. And then it would seem then from this that one would be allowed to commit suicide to prevent this before, in a situation where a person would eventually be killed, it would seem to avoid the torture. But this flies in the face of the previous citation, Rav Hanani ben Trajan, who killed himself, who refused to commit suicide to avoid the pain. One could learn in the Shulchan Aruch that it is not a heter, because it's not, we don't just, it's merely we allow this to occur. But rather, it is a, if after the fact it was done, and if a person did it under these trying circumstances, then one is not deprived of this. In other words, we can't condemn the person, even though perhaps he, if he would have asked the Shaila, he would have been told no. However, the Rosh, who is the source of this, says, uses the expression, it's mutter, that it's allowed, which again puts us back to square one. How does this citation, how does one understand this together with the citation in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, V'Chanina ben Trajan, who refused to commit the suicide? The only one that I saw discuss this point is the Tiferes Yisroel. Yisroel Lipschitz, in his commentary on the Mishnahs on Yoma, in the last chapter, where he describes that humiliation was an added factor. It wasn't a question of just to relieve pain, but it was the humiliation. In other words, he made fun of. This terrible degradation, coupled with the physical pain, would be which shows, but one again could not compare it to a situation where it would just be purely pain. That's this Tiferes Yisroel's resolution. I didn't see anyone, another resolution. Again, how it goes back to the fighters of Masada, though, it would seem that the women who would be taken for prostitution from the sources would have had would be allowed to commit suicide, perhaps. But the men would not, at least from the sources that we have here. Okay, 2 weeks from now was the next class. We will be discussing diaspora. What was Jewish life like during this period? What was the language that they speak? How did they act? What was their educational system? That's in 2 weeks. And now, says I'm open for any questions. The heter of torture is only if they would be killed. It's not clear they would have been killed because the Romans were interested in using them as slaves. And this was common. They didn't necessarily, at times, but they didn't necessarily kill them. Some they killed. But others that they just left and kept alive as slaves. Yes. That really is the whole question of the revolt in itself. And again, there seems the rabbinic opinion, the Pharisees, and as the Purushim was, they were very much against the revolt as a whole. But the question is, but now they are stuck. They're stuck. What are they supposed to do? The argument that Eliezer ben Yoer had made, that it's better to die than to be a slave, would seem from our sources would not be grounds for suicide. In terms of the women being used for moral purposes, perhaps it would be. Yes. Just a one really could only speculate, because Josephus does not really shed light here of why the Romans felt it so necessary. The question is why the Romans felt it so necessary to destroy Masada. There actually could be two reasons. One is because of the Roman dignity itself. you know, these people, you know, were flaunting the Romans by saying, ha ha, you didn't get us. The other is that I'm sure because since they were bent, they still were, you know, they didn't leave, like, they didn't, you know, run away to, and this was not a group who ran away to Egypt. I mean, it could be they were still a menace for the populace. In other words, they would go down and they would make raiding parties with them. So they looked at this. Again, we can only speculate, but it's quite likely that they, in the past, we do know from the sources that they did have raiding parties. So it's quite likely they did continue. So they looked at them really as a menace. But one could only speculate.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.